So, good morning, everyone. What's on my mind to talk about this morning is something to do with the process of mindfulness practice, or the process of Buddhist practice, and over time. And it can be over a short time, it can be over a longer time. And in order to do this, I'd like to borrow from observations that anthropologists have made about rites of initiation. And starting maybe in the beginning of the last century, anthropologists got very interested in rites of initiation in different cultures. They would go around and study different cultures, especially what they called non-modern cultures. They probably had other words then, but non-modern cultures, with the idea that cultures that were not modern, cultures like in the Amazon, Indians, or various places, that they would exhibit the different phases of initiation, different process of initiation, in ways that were much more clear to see than how you find in modern society. And so then we can maybe use that to help understand what we do in a better way through the clarity that they offer. So I don't know if that thesis is so valid, but in any case, people studied many different cultures, and they came up with a number of different universal or near-universal steps in this process of initiation. And the first, and it could be kind of summarized in three stages. The first is separation, the process of separating oneself from one's normal life. And the second has to do with being in an in-between time, in-between place, in-between realities, in-between places. One anthropologist calls it the liminal. Like the word limit comes from the word limis in limen in kind of Latin, which means a threshold. So to be at a threshold where you haven't gone through yet, but you've left behind what's on the other side, where you came from. Then the third stage is a stage of transformation. And sometimes that's a stage where you go back into your old reality, old world in some ways, or is now new, but you've been transformed in some way. You've changed in some way, or your vision and understanding has been changed. Somehow in the transformation process, in this liminal stage, you've maybe touched some aspect of the sacred, some aspect of yourself. You maybe had some encounter with your God or some sacred being, something that triggers some transformation. And I think that this process is useful in order to understand much of our life, not just simply meditation or Buddhist spirituality, but even all kinds of regular, ordinary activities in our life. If we want to see kind of the opportunity that's there in all of life, kind of understand kind of some of the process that's happening for us, whether we know it or not, but also the process that's happening for us that can give birth to something new. I think of the process of especially the process of being in an in-between state, kind of in limbo, I guess we call it, is often a very important stage for people to be in. It's often a transition stage for people between the old and what's going to happen. And it's a process maybe that's you know, it's kind of a time when something's going to be moved through us or give birth or something's about to happen. And it can be a quite beautiful stage for some people, but it can also be quite difficult and painful, as, you know, the giving birth can be both those things. Now, each of these three stages, I think, have their challenges and have their opportunity. To go and sit in meditation is, to some degree, to separate ourselves from a normal life. To go on retreat, which Buddhists often do, is to separate ourselves from our normal life. And there's many ways in which we come to separate ourselves. Even to come to meditation center can be seen, in a sense, separation. But many situations in our life, we're separating ourselves from something which is conventional, or normal, or ordinary that we're used to, in order to maybe see things in a new way and not have the habitual ways of understanding things. And often that separation time is some of the most challenging times people have to separate ourselves from what's customary, to put ourselves in a situation where our sense of self is not what it has been. Often when people go into this liminal, into this in-between time, it's a place where their normal social identities don't apply. And it kind of, in some places, people, in some kind of ritual, or people will shave their heads or put on robes in Buddhist world. Kind of becoming monastic is kind of becoming a permanent in-between person. Sometimes people get new names. Sometimes people get, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which kind of the normal social identity is kind of stripped away from you. And then having that social identity stripped away is often very, very painful for people. It might be easier in some formal rite of initiation if the whole culture has kind of been built around that, and as when you become a teenager and there's a rite of passage into adulthood or whatever, it's kind of understood this is the process. But many people who go into the world of spirituality and meditation don't really understand, they might understand intellectually, but really in their gut, the degree to which we're kind of dropping so much of our normal conventional ways of seeing ourselves, understanding ourselves, and relating to the world around us. And sometimes we need almost like a ritual in order to encourage us to let go fully enough from the normal ways in which we have holding on to ourselves. I remember when I was living in Japan, I was told that I knew that, you know, Japanese culture in some ways is a very structured society. Everybody has a kind of role and a place, and in some ways a kind of hierarchical structure, and you kind of learn who's higher than you in the hierarchy, and you learn to talk to them a certain way. And maybe in many ways very similar to what it was like in England just some decades ago, and maybe still to a little bit degree. And so, you know, people's social position was very well understood. People kind of knew it when you met a stranger, kind of you figured out where they were and the social structure. And all that worked, except in the bathhouse. And there, everybody would take their clothes off, and they'd be in the sauna together or whatever. And there, people would treat each other as equals, because somehow that was a liminal. That was an in-between time where everything kind of dropped away. Sometimes carnival time is a time in societies where, you know, people separate themselves from all the normal ways of behaving, and even sometimes the normal ethical behaviors, the mores of a society. And then it kind of this freedom occurs, and people do all kinds of things that for all kinds of purposes and all kinds of values. But the separation part, to be willing to let go, and you see it just in you know, sitting down to meditate, even just for 40 minutes, that the mind has such a strong momentum to be still caught up and concerned with normal, everyday kind of things. From the most petty, you know, from, you know, what I'm having for dinner today, to sometimes the very significant and very powerful and meaningful things for us, because, you know, the mind carries the momentum, the concerns, the preoccupation with those things. And part of the process of meditation then is learning to separate ourselves from all those concerns, at least separating ourselves enough so that we stand outside, we stand in between with the mindfulness, so the awareness, our attention, is not engulfed, entangled, lost in those things. So mindfulness itself can be seen as a place within us, in our psyche, which is this in-between place, where when we're mindful, when the awareness is luminous or clear or strong, that there's part of us which is no longer entangled from the normal things we're concerned about. And that's a big challenge for the psyche, to learn to let go of its attachments, its clinging, its fears, in order to be willing to drop or let go of, or to stand independent from, to stand separate from, so many of things that we're so entangled with. It's not a judgment about the world, not a judgment about things we're involved in, but it's a judgment, if anything, about the entanglement, the way we are with the world. And mindfulness doesn't necessarily mean separating ourselves physically from the world like you would in a traditional rite of passage. But there's still a process of separation or becoming independent. I like the word independent a lot. The word, classic word in the Buddhist technical language for meditation is viveka. Viveka is usually taken as being be separate or be solitary or solitude. It's a process of meditation where a person becomes separate or solitary from everything else. I think that doesn't have good connotations here in the West. And probably a better translation for us is the word independent. We learn to become independent, and that's a good American kind of idea, right? And it maybe it buys in too much to the problems of American individualism, but still, the psyche has a place where it becomes independent. And so that process of negotiating that in meditation, what is it that's happening? Where am I holding on to now? What can I let go of? What do I need to do in order to enter into this in-between place where my normal idea of who I am, the normal idea of what society is, normal all kinds of things, all the conventional customary concepts we have, I can put down for a while. Often people go into the wilderness for this kind of activity, right? Maybe many of you, to some degree, have been off into the wilderness some way. And often so much of the usual way in which we relate to people and ourselves and what's really important for us and doesn't relate so much anymore out there. I have a nice shirt on today, I think. I think it's nice. And if I'm about town a little bit and going out for lunch with someone who I respect, and I'd feel a little bit funny if I had spilled ketchup on it. But you go up into the Sierras and you've been out backpacking for 3 or 4 days and you spill ketchup on your shirt and you meet someone on a trail and, those kind of concerns aren't there because you kind of let go of so much. And then that's part of the reason why it's so relaxing to go off into the wilderness or go on vacation. And then you come back and then, and rather than having been transformed by all that, we just use that as a time for a relief from it all. And then we come back and it all starts all up again. But to allow this process of unfolding to move, the process of initiation, so that there can be some real transformation, it helps to know the process, know this is a possibility in any situation. The process of separation is not just simply physical separation, both of the body and the mind, but also this is forced on us at times. We have all kinds of tragedies occur in our life, and the way things should be, the way we hold ourselves as the ideal me or and we get separated from our loved ones. We get separated from our work. Many people lose their jobs these days. We get separated from, so much. Reality takes things away from us. And then, it's a separation time. And we could just feel terrible about it and regretful and sad, which is inevitable, I think. But, this is where sometimes giving birth is very painful, too. Because that very process of being separated from things in a kind of tragic way also is a time for something new to be born. And if you say to someone, something new is going to be about to be born, your husband just died, it's kind of like not the right thing to say, I think. But in fact, there can be that process sometimes where, something new is about to happen. And sometimes, we look back 20 years later or 10 years later and realize we entered into a tremendous limbo, uncertainty and chaos and confusion. But that period was very necessary for some transformation to happen. I'm thinking of the famous Buddhist story of Kiso Gotami, who lost her child. And the story for her is a little bit that she Kisa means frail or thin. And she was this frail, poor woman who apparently, was kind of maybe, I don't know if she was orphaned or something, but very poor and kind of an outcast kind of person and didn't have much prospects in life. But then eventually she was able to get married. And one of the really key things in classic Indian society is a person, especially a woman, had her position in society in relationship to the men around her, her husband and her sons and her father. And so who we are, how we're safe and how we find our place in society was very dependent on those relationships. And here she was this poor woman who finally found herself into a family situation where she had some safety and food and things. And after some time, she didn't give birth to any child. And if you don't give birth to a child, it's kind of like, I've heard stories of how in some old days, maybe, I don't know if it's still the case in Indian societies, that until a woman gives birth to a son, she's still a little bit outside the family and doesn't have much respect. So finally, Kiso Gotami gives birth to a son. And her son dies. So it's very meaningful. It's always meaningful when a son dies, but it has tremendous meaning for this woman that maybe can be different than kind of what it means for us. And she gets crazed. And she goes around carrying, she refuses to accept the fact that her son has died. And she carries this child around with her, going to house, asking people for medicine to bring him back to health. And she's described as being kind of crazed. And finally, someone sends her to the Buddha. He has the medicine for you. The medicine. This morning, my son was... I took a little bit of medicine this morning, and my son said, why are you always taking metacin? And he knew what he was saying. You know, he knew the difference between medicine and metacin. Have you had your metacin recently? Metta, for those who don't know, is the Buddhist word for loving kindness. And so the Buddha had medicine, and so she went to the Buddha with a great expectation, hope for a cure. And he said, "Oh yeah, I can help you. And what you need to do is you need to go into the village and collect mustard seeds, which is very common in India. Everybody would, you know, with curries and stuff, they'd have mustard, and they grind it up. And so go and find get a mustard seed from every house that has not been visited by death." She's full of hope, you know. Wow, this is easy. She knows how easy it is to get mustard seeds. And she knocks on the doors, and can I have some, you know, mustard seed? Oh, of course you can have, you know, one. But I have to ask you first, has anybody died here in this household? Oh, yes. You know, not just once, but, you know, we've been generations here in this house, and generations of people have died here in all kinds of ways, and children and grandparents and parents. And she goes around, and the same story happens. And after a while, she realizes the universality of death. And something about that realization transforms her. She's in this limbo time where she's not really accepting, you know, what's happened. She hasn't really allowed the separation to really occur. But somehow, by seeing universality of death, somehow she's able to see this, you know, separate herself. Separate in this situation, maybe, is really admit what's really happened. And then she's somehow transformed, or potentially transformed, and she goes to the Buddha, then and becomes the Buddha's disciple, and eventually becomes fully transformed in the sense of becoming enlightened. So there's all kinds of ways in which reality presents us with separation. We get sick, and we go to the hospital, and the hospitalization itself is kind of, you know, when you get hospitalized, you're being separated from everything that, you know, much of what you know and what you're used to and who you are. And, you know, maybe you're attached to being able to take care of yourself, and that's been taken away from you. And you've been attached to making decisions for yourself, and that's been taken away from you. I met a woman recently whose husband was so close to death that they already had the eulogy prepared. She was actually going to grief counseling already before he died, because that's what's, you know, he was in the hospital in Toronto during the time of the SARS epidemic, and she couldn't even go see him because he didn't have SARS, but everybody was quarantined. Here he was, you know, on his death, you know, bed, kind of, and she couldn't go see him because, you know, it was Toronto and SARS. And at some point they started pulling out the tubes to let him die. Then he rallied. Now he's home. But, you know, this radical separation from, you know, that happens in so many different circumstances in life. And then we end up in this limbo, this in-between time, this transition time, that in itself can be very disorienting and very difficult and painful for that reason, especially if we haven't let go completely, if we're still expecting to have the old orientation, the old ways. And part of the transformation that can happen in the limbo time is a fulfillment, a continuation of this process of letting go and discovering some place of being, some place of rest, some place of surrender, where we've surrendered from all the old ways, all these old customary things that we're used to. And I was reminded recently of the 12-step program, where I guess, I don't know it that well, but it's there, they talk about in order to conquer, you have to surrender. Isn't that great? So sometimes there has to be this great surrender that happens in this, you know, to go into this, you know, and that's what's called for in the rites of initiation, for sometimes very dramatic ones. You surrender everything. And only when you've surrendered everything, when you've surrendered your ego and your identity and all these things, then you're ready to be initiated. Then you're ready to be offered or offered some powerful new insight or tool or ritual or teaching or something. And it's not so uncommon in traditional societies for people to have to be initiated before they're taught something. And here in the West, you know, we get teaching so freely. And I've heard Zen teachers complain sometimes about other teachers. I don't know if they're Zen teachers, but of certainly this criticism would apply to me and to Vipassana teachers. We explain too much. You know, and we explain too easily. We just kind of lay it all out there, kind of, you know, and that's, you know, the map and everything. And you really, you know, and you know, the Vipassana, this very insight meditation we do, is considered traditionally in Theravadan Buddhism to be the cream of Buddhist practice, the pinnacle. And you can just go down to Kaiser and be taught it, right? You know, it's, or come just walk off the street here in Birch Street, and, you know, here we are. And we don't ask anything of you, and, you know, just we tell you to pay attention, and you think it's an innocent thing to do. But you often have years of preparation before you're told to pay attention. Imagine that. If only my mother had known that when I was a teenager. But you know, the idea is you prepare yourself, and often a period of surrender and all that before you're taught these kinds of things. So then you get ready. And then there's you're offered something, or something happens to you, or some contact with the sacred, some contact with something. And with Kisa Gotami, maybe it was some contact with the world of compassion. And I know many people who enter into tremendous worlds of suffering, and there's no way of suggesting how to make it better, but they come out of that, and their capacity for suffering has changed so much. And they're able to meet people in a different way. I think, you know, back to 9/11, and I think that, you know, in some ways that people have talked about that being a sacred moment in the United States, not to diminish the tragedy, the tremendous tragedy it was, but sacred in the sense that for many people it was a turning point in themselves and in their life, where they made choices and decisions about that were completely new, about where they wanted to take their lives and what they wanted to do. For some people it was more a life of service and emphasizing that. And for some people it was, you know, being more diligent and connecting to their family and friends and telling them how much you love them. And there's, you know, some kind of transformation. And I think when tragedy occurs, that unless there's some kind of, unless we take it in enough to allow ourselves to be changed by it, you know, I guess I don't want to be careful not to kind of judge it exactly, but certainly there's a lost opportunity. But I think that if a tragedy is big enough, unless we somehow take it in enough and allow ourselves to be changed and have our intentions and our priorities in some ways changed, I think we do a kind of violence to ourselves. And I can't explain to you exactly why that's the case. So something as dramatic as 9/11, unless we are somehow changed and allow ourselves to be changed and make new choices because of it, I think it remains a kind of a violence to ourselves. Maybe the violence takes the form of a kind of numbness or kind of shutting down or something. So some transformation happens. And so we sit in meditation. We separate ourselves from our normal conventional ideas of self. And it's a whole process. It takes, you know, it's the easy things happen maybe in a few minutes, and the difficult things happen in 10 years, you know, in meditation. And then we're in this limbo state, and often disoriented, and often we don't know who we are. We kind of, maybe it's a delight not to know who you are. People in Buddhist circles often talk about the state of not knowing and being this place of not knowing and how profound it is. A place of surrender, where we're kind of allowing something new to happen, come through us, to give birth to us. And sometimes the transition period, the limbo stage, is a long time. And you can't really know how long it's going to last. It can last, it depends on what particular process we're going through. It could be very short, it could be, you know, minutes. It could be, you know, a period of meditation. It could be a retreat. It could be years, depending on what it is. We kind of feel some part of us is kind of, we don't really know where where our feet are going to land, where we are. And so then, you know, having the patience, having the willingness, or having the support from the teachers and community to it's okay, this is where you're at now, and it's appropriate, it's fine. Sometimes I've encouraged people to, I've been told them very clearly, you know, you're right now, you're in limbo now, and you need to be there. And it's really important to kind of let the psyche do what, the unseen aspects of the psyche kind of, you know, do what it needs to do in this limbo stage. And if you rush to try to fill it, and rush to find purpose or meaning in your life or activity or this or that, that, you know, there's problems there. I don't know why this comes to mind right now, I'm thinking of that expression when someone separates from like a divorce, and then there's the rebound effect, you know, and the person didn't allow themselves a period of transition, of limbo, and they kind of rush to fill the void, and sometimes I guess it works out, but sometimes, you know, it doesn't work out because the person's not really ready for a relationship. And sometimes maybe it does work out, but it works out only because the person has gone back to safe, old, familiar ways. And so it's nice and comfortable again, but the opportunity that was there for some real period of transition and limbo and transformation, that opportunity wasn't taken advantage of. And the transformation time, you know, to be transformed by all this, often comes from, in Buddhism, say it comes from a vision, from seeing, darshana, kensho in Zen, you know, to see into one's nature. Some kind of vision, where we see and understand things in a new way. Often it's a change of heart, where our heart has now been opened in ways that can never be closed again, or hopefully not be closed again. In theistic religions, or many other processes, this contact with the sacred that often happens in spiritual initiation processes is sometimes with the other, with some other, with a god or gods or sacred animal that you have some relationship to, or some other. And it's certainly some way of you can say that in Buddhism, that there's some vision or some contact with some other, with the Dharma, with some other sense of presence or reality or something. But probably it's safest in Buddhist terminology to say that it's a contact with some, it's more of an inner contact, it's an inner transformation, rather than some outer contact with the god and stuff, something like that. But rather it's contact with some inner sacred possibility within ourselves. So certainly compassion is that. And compassion has a lot to do with the world around us and contacting others. But also contacting that part of inside of ourselves where freedom is possible, where the heart is free and unburdened, unshackled, unconstricted, not afraid. Some possibility within ourselves where we've actually learned to let go enough that letting go opens up to some sense of sacred presence, some sacred awareness, some transformative possibility where the old ways don't have to burden us anymore. And to taste that, and then go back into society with that as a vision, as a possibility, can change one's priorities, can change how one wants to live one's life, in simple ways and in radical ways. It can change it as simple as, you know, when I go to work, I don't think I want to be always go to work, you know, filled with my ambition or filled with my preoccupation, concerns, and fears of what needs to be done, so that I don't have some time where I just a few minutes at least, where I check in and see how my colleagues are. Who knows how they are? Who knows what happened overnight for them? And, you know, let's go in with some kind of openness, some kind of presence so that you can be, you know. So that can be a small transformation, small change. Or it can be, you know, quite big. A person can see, wow, if that's what's possible, if that level of freedom is possible, and if the opposite of that, the way I was so enslaved, so burdened by not just big attachments and identities, but even just the way in which my thinking works. My thinking used to be so caught up with suffering and clinging. Even when I thought about what was for dinner, there was suffering in that thinking. I had no idea. It said, you know, for a saint, how does the expression go? That even the smallest transgression is like dropping salt into your eyes or salt in your wound or something, because they're hypersensitive. And what happens in mindfulness, and part of the reason why it's so transformative, is that as the mindfulness gets very, very powerful, we understand the degree to which clinging and suffering is something we carry with us, even the subtlest ways in which the mind works. If we're preoccupied and concerned with things of the world all the time and busy, you might even think things are going great. But, at some deeper level of the psyche, things are not so great. So a person might kind of really, through a spiritual practice, realize the depth of possibility of freedom and just be in awe, in amazement at the degree of suffering that exists in the world. So a vision of the degree in which the world is filled with suffering, and then a vision of the possibility of an alternative to that. That every other pursuit in life might not have much meaning. And so the whole person then chooses, the whole new way of living their life that is to really be of service in a radical way to the people around them and try to touch this place or meet this place with other people and show that possibility. So there's a wide range of transformations. Transformation into possibilities of love and living from places of love. Transformation of living from places of being ethical. Realizing how beautiful it is to be ethical, and transformation into right speech and how we speak to others. Some time ago, a friend of mine, I don't know if I need to say this, but anyway, right speech, right? Transformation into right speech, talking about each other in ways. And so all this, so to allow ourselves to be transformed, to allow ourselves to be separate, to allow the separation that reality has forced on us to occur and not to resist it, to take it in, to give some space in our days to be in limbo and transition, even though it's, when it's very painful, not to rush to fill it, not to rush to solve it, but allow something new to be born inside of you, through you, with you, to give birth to something. And then to really take that on enough so there's a transformation of vision at least, a change of heart. And then, it might be easier to have a change of heart, have a transformation, than it is then to live by that transformation. So part of the transformation then is to, part of this process then is to really acknowledge and notice what's happened to you and appreciate the value of it. And then really, see, this is something that, this is some way in which I want to change my life and live my life in new ways. And how can I support that and make that possible and do that? So I think that it might be an interesting way of looking at your life in the most subtle kind of mundane ways and also in the biggest pictures to look and see if you can notice these three stages: separation, in between, and transformation. And see if you can find it in all kinds of ways. So those are my thoughts for this morning. And anybody like to ask any questions or comment on that, or maybe someone has an example in their own life?
In wanting to remember what you, in the three stages, it stands for sit.
Sorry?
Stands for sit.
Oh. You all hear that? Separation, in between, and transformation. If you take that, the first letter of each word, you have the acronym SIT. It's the nature of being in transition that we don't know often. Sometimes a guide can know more than you can know. Sometimes having a guide can be helpful. And sometimes you might have some sense, some intuition. And sometimes it's useful to go faster than slower, you know, and accelerate the process by going on retreat, for example, or, you know, going into the wilderness or going spending the day at the beach and just really kind of be you alone with the ocean there. And that can, you know, help. Sometimes it's useful to understand much better some of the emotions and reactions that are coming to being in limbo. And it might be that being in transition is not really the painful situation, but rather it's some relationship to that, the fear around it perhaps, or the grieving that is part of it. And so we need to kind of relate to that grieving, or we need to relate to the fear. And sometimes what's needed in limbo is to find some place to hold it, or hold oneself in that situation where there can be a lot of love. And I think sometimes these rites of initiations, you know, can be rites of love where you separate yourself and you come to a situation where in the ritual there's a lot of support and love. You know, rites of passages for teenagers, you know. Sometimes you gather with a teenage girl might gather with a group of women, and it's a rite of passage, and you enter this in-between place, but it's, you know, this, in your community of women, it's full of love and care. And that's what's needed. So there's a lot of things that sometimes best to do nothing, and sometimes speed it up, sometimes slow it down, sometimes find what's needed in that that needs to, that brings balance. Or yes.
In the 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a saying: as soon as you start drinking, you stop growing. And it took me a while to figure that out. And the answer to that is that the alcoholic anesthetizes himself from all his pain, and anything that happens to him is disagreeable. And the kind of violence he does to himself, he doesn't grow from it. And from learning that, I started to sit with all my painful things that happened to me. And I found that they were very instructional. They're healing and very transforming.
Thank you very much. I completely agree with you. I have tremendous faith that it's kind of like the human psyche is built to be self-healing. And if we take our suffering as being a solid, fixed thing, and this is the way it is, and we either avoid it or we continue holding on to it, we interrupt that self-healing process. And you know, everything, you know, almost everything that occurs in the psyche, both the suffering and the happiness, can be seen as a doorway to greater freedom So what you discovered is beautiful.
I learned that we only grow through pain.
Well, we grow through...
The thing you have to remember is it doesn't last forever.
The pain?
It doesn't really take very long. You can distract yourself with television, all kinds of things. Uh-huh.
I've been so inspired so many times by people who have been willing to sit with some suffering. And an open-ended way. It's kind of like this limbo. You don't know how long it's going to be. Just sit with it. And then sit and sit and sit and sit and sit. And sometimes you wonder, you know, well, how come these people have this confidence? They can just keep sitting with it, you know, for all this time. And but somehow they have it. And then some point, you know, oh. Someone recently said that underneath all the suffering was love. Person, you know. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your comments. It was really helpful. Early on when you were speaking, I felt my body kind of react when you talked about there's a kind of possible violence that we can do to ourselves by not honoring the pacing of the in-between. And then later on, towards the end, I have this image. There's a long period I'm going through, and there's a lot of energy that arises that get the hell out of here. And the image that came into my mind, which I also went like that, was I'm giving birth and I'm on the table. The baby isn't out yet, and I leap off the table. That's not too helpful, but I could really feel in the body the energy to get away, and also the kind of violence that can do, not just to myself, but to others,
yeah.
Babies and
yeah.
Families.
Thank you. You know, to interrupt the process, to run away, to not study the process, see what's needed. You talked about giving birth. I don't think that's part of it. I don't know if it's a direct connection, so I don't take this as a statement towards you, please. But I was reminded of when I lived on the farm in Tennessee, big community, and they wrote a book called Spiritual Midwifery, and they had this—they're kind of the priests of the community were the midwives, and in a real sense, you know, the people and the mediators to the sacred. And we often heard stories about how some couple would give birth, the woman was going to give birth, and it wasn't happening, it wasn't happening. And then these spiritual midwives, these priests, you know, these women would go and say, you know, the two of you need to talk about something. Something, you know, there's something going on here. And in fact, there was some resentment or something, you know, that unfinished business. And they would, you know, there on the, you know, birthing table, you know, they would, you know, start talking about what was really going on with them and be really honest. And then the baby would come. So the importance of, you know, not just being, you know, sitting with the suffering, but looking to see how can we be more honest, what's really going on. Well, thank you for this wonderful in-between time together. Let's go out and get transformed.